Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast for constitutional law. In this episode, we're going to begin talking about the different powers and structures of government, and we're going to kick that off with talking about the judiciary. If you would go ahead and open the slides for week four, you'll see that we have about three objectives with this set of slides, and part of these slides are going to include our first real introductions to and explanations of different Supreme Court decisions, going all the way back to the 1800s. Just to clarify those objectives, if you don't have the slides immediately in front of you, we're going to begin by getting an introduction to what is known as judicial review, which is, frankly, the single greatest power the Supreme Court ever really, not so much invented, but declared for itself. We're then going to talk about other concepts associated with the power of the court, and these would be things that hopefully you encountered in last week's readings of the cases that I suggested. It's going to include things like mootness, ripeness, standing, and a little known concept, but rather important, justiciability. Then we're going to turn to the five cases on the power of the judiciary this week with a wide range. We're going to go all the way back to the case known as Marbury versus Madison, and we're going to wrap up with something that was decided just recently in 2023, the case called Moore v. Harper. But before I get down that track too far, let's go back to talking about what judicial review is. The definition that you'll see on slide three is that it is the power of the courts, and I mean all courts, not just the Supreme Court, to review laws that are passed by a legislative body or an action or set of actions taken by the executive branch, and essentially the courts get to determine whether that is constitutional or not. Are the laws constitutional? Are the actions constitutional? And if not, based on our existing structure of the Constitution in Article 6, well, those things just don't get to stand. So Article 6 of the Constitution establishes that the Constitution itself is the supreme law of the land. And therefore, anything that comes into contradiction or violates that really has to be struck down. Article 6 goes further and actually establishes that federal law and treaties are also the supreme law of the land. So anything that would come into conflict with those would also have to be held as unconstitutional or struck down by the court that is reviewing those laws or those actions, again, that would conflict with existing federal treaties or federal law. Now, what you'll see on that slide that defines judicial review, this is slide three, are pictures to the right-hand side of Justice John Marshall, and then William Marbury is pictured bottom left, and on bottom right is James Madison. Now, this is a really interesting case which actually implicated Chief Justice Marshall and something he failed to do, but I want to get into that a little bit later. The reason I've highlighted the case that is tied here, the Marbury versus Madison case, is because this is where we see the most basic and direct explanation and really pronouncement by Marshall of the existence of judicial review as a power of the courts, and in this case, the Supreme Court itself. On slide four, what you're going to see is an explanation of the law that Marshall struck down in that decision of Marbury versus Madison. It was the Judiciary Act of 1801, and it was known less formally as the Midnight Judges Act. So what happens in this context is you have John Adams transitioning out of power and Thomas Jefferson stepping in. The entire election of 1800 was extremely contentious, and Adams and Jefferson are not friends. In fact, the transition of Jefferson and his inauguration is one of the few times that a prior president does not show up to the inauguration of a following president. What happens in this context, and what you really need to understand, is that John Adams had passed this act in an effort to install a number of judges who were associated with his Federalist Party. Now, that is not the party of Thomas Jefferson. And so the thought was, with Jefferson stepping in, they wanted to fill a bunch of positions and even create positions within the federal judiciary so as to give the Federalists more power. And there were about 16 new judgeships that Adams created at that point in time. Of course, as you can see in the graphic, it goes further than that. It actually reduced the Supreme Court's number. It created three new circuit courts. It reorganized the district courts. We're looking at a really big shift. There are certainly a lot of politics in play. And when the case comes to Marshall and his court, he is sitting as the Chief Justice at that point in time, they have to look over the actions associated with this act, and not only that, but they go back to the Judiciary Act of 1789. Now, 1789, we are talking about the time period immediately following the ratification of the Constitution. And Article 3 of the Constitution, which established the judiciary, was very, very brief. So the first Congress sets up the court structure through that Judiciary Act of 1789, and this act of 1801 then goes back and modifies that. And all of this is to say that the structure of the courts is still very contested. Nobody has a solid sense of what this should look like, and so you can see drastic shifts and changes. And those shifts and changes are meant to align certain political parties with power. In essence, what you see is a packing of the court, so to speak, on the behalf of John Adams through this Judiciary Act of 1801. And this kicks into play a whole lot of follow-up, and specifically that case of Marbury versus Madison. Now, as I said before, I'm not going to jump into more of the details of the case, but I do want to talk about that judicial review power. And here's where I'm going to tie in the fact that this isn't an invention of the Supreme Court. A lot of people treat Marbury versus Madison as the court just pulling judicial review out of thin air. But it does no such thing. In fact, what it's doing is going back to the ideas that were specified in the debates over ratification. And in particular, if you look at Federalist number 78, which was written by Alexander Hamilton and explained in a little bit of detail on slide 5, what he writes there is that the interpretation of the laws is the proper and peculiar province of the courts. A constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law. It therefore belongs to them to ascertain its meaning, as well as the meaning of any particular act proceeding from the legislative body. Marshall takes these words and he basically utilizes them to say, because it is the, you know, express domain of the judiciary to ascertain the meaning of a constitution, they also get to explain those things that might fundamentally conflict with that constitution. And not just that, but because of that supremacy clause in Article 6, we also have to take the further step of protecting the Constitution by striking down anything that would violate its basic components. Judicial review is a truly extensive and really wide-spanning power of the courts. It applies to acts of Congress, it applies to presidential actions and initiatives. And in the instance that a state law or state action comes into conflict with the Constitution, that is also open to the Supreme Court to strike down as unconstitutional. We might think here of the types of actions taken during the Civil Rights Movement with respect to segregation of the schools. Many states at that time continued to engage in segregation in their school systems, and the Supreme Court ultimately struck those actions and policies down as unconstitutional because it violated the Constitution and the 14th Amendment. So judicial review is essentially a power that the court, while it may have been recognized before, was somewhat self-granted by virtue of what is written in Marbury versus Madison. But the court also has self-imposed limits on its ability to issue decisions, and these are things that the court sticks pretty closely to. If you look at slide 8, what that's going to lay out are those self-imposed limits, and there's a series of different important concepts listed here that we need to make sure we're clear on. First, the court, the Supreme Court in particular, will not give advisory opinions or opinions that exist outside of some sort of real conflict. It needs a true case or controversy. It's not going to decide things based on hypothetical possibilities. It's only going to decide cases or controversies that exist and that are truly today happening or ongoing. Again, it can't give advice. It's going to deal with real situations. Limit number two is that the case must have what is called standing. Now, standing is something we addressed in terms of the cases that you read last week, in particular, the FDA case, which has the FDA versus the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, as well as the case of Atchison Hotels versus Laufer. So in both of those cases, the justices write pretty extensively in their decisions about standing and what standing is. Standing as a concept means some party in the case must have some possibility of suffering an injury, or it must have suffered an injury. And what they've tried to explain this as is there must be some harm that either could be experienced or has been experienced. You can't just bring a case to the Supreme Court based on there might be harm, right? There has to be a real possibility of this happening. And in each of those cases that I had you read, Atchison Hotels and the FDA case, what the Supreme Court is dealing with is, are these individuals or are these groups actually going to be harmed? In the Atchison Hotels case, the individual who's going onto those websites and determining whether there's actually disability indications related to the hotels and their rooms, is that person actually harmed if they never had any intention of going to those hotels in the first place? With the FDA case and the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, the argument from the doctors was there's a possibility that we may have to engage in emergency medicine related to someone who has complications from the abortion medication. But what the Supreme Court came back and said was, well, that's a hypothetical and fairly unlikely, so we don't really have standing in this instance, okay? The other thing about standing that's important to know is that the injury needs to be something that can actually be addressed by the court. If it's not a fix or a solution that the court can provide, then really maybe this isn't the place for it, so the court may not accept that case. Now, in a lot of instances, maybe we would think there isn't an immediate fix for something, but courts offer the opportunity to get at least economic remedies in a lot of situations. So there's quite a few things that we would say could be quote unquote addressed by a court, at least in economic terms. And that may be why we still see a lot of court cases where perhaps it doesn't seem like there's anything the court can do, but it can require someone to pay another person some sort of amount of money to repair the damage or to at least try and provide some remedy of some type to the person who suffered the injury. Issue number three, or self-imposed limit number three, that is that the issue in the case is not supposed to be moot, meaning it needs to be present at the time the court considers it. If whatever the problem was has already been resolved, then the court has no reason to step in and try and do anything about it. But this one I've got a couple of asterisks next to, because even when sometimes there are cases where the issue might now appear to be resolved or unaddressable by the court, they do still take and keep the case. The most classic example of this is actually Roe versus Wade. Because the case took several months to get through the court system, by the time it actually reached the Supreme Court, Jane Doe, or Roe was the name it was actually under, because we didn't actually identify the person by their name, she'd already actually had the child at that point in time. So what the case was about, the ability to seek out an abortion or to terminate one's pregnancy, was long since passed. That remedy was not on the table anymore. But the court said because this issue could arise again in the future for other individuals, it was not moot. So this is one of those inherently difficult things to consider and think about. And it's actually the other case that you read last week, FBI versus FCRA, where the individual in that case was suing because they had been placed on the no-fly list. They'd actually been detained. And then the FBI says, but this won't arise again because we've taken them off the no-fly list. So it's not like they're not going to be able to return to the United States in the future. Well, there's actually no guarantee that that's the case. So while the FBI may have taken them off the list at this point in time, we can't be sure that they won't put FCRA back on that no-fly list in the future. And so the court again said, nope, this is not moot. The issue is still very much alive and something that we can address and fix, so to speak. But if it is not, if the issue is truly something that we are past the point of fixing or it's resolved itself in some way, the court is not likely to take the case because it would be quote-unquote moot. A fourth limit that the court imposes on itself or on the cases that it takes is that the case must be quote-unquote ripe. Now, this must mean the dispute's real, the case has been well-developed, and it's gone through all the stages of the judicial process that it needs to before it's being considered by the Supreme Court. If it hasn't gone through the process fully, if it hasn't been heard by a lower court and there's not a decision already on the facts of the case, if it hasn't been appealed in the right way, the Supreme Court wants to let those steps play out because it wants to wait and take the case at the right time. An example of this, which more recently happened, was a case involving the state of Idaho and the United States. The state of Idaho has an abortion ban in place, and that abortion ban or that law actually creates some level of emergency exemption related to the mother's life. When the United States initially filed the case against the state of Idaho, they argued that the law in Idaho violated a federal law known as EMTALA. EMTALA requires emergency care for an individual if their life is in danger, even if that relates to abortion, right? So this case makes its way to the Supreme Court after having gone through prior lower level courts. And yet when it got to the court, the case itself is not able to actually be resolved because the two sides couldn't agree on what their actual disagreement was. Did the Idaho law violate U.S. law or did it not? And although the Supreme Court took the case thinking that this was ripe and ready for a decision, they actually dismissed it because of the fact that the two sides didn't agree on what the conflict was over. So this would be a case in which you might say the controversy or the issue was not ripe for a decision because we weren't even totally sure that we had a conflict here. The final self-imposed limit for the Supreme Court is that a case must be justiciable. And that means it has to be able to be decided by a court and that it isn't something that one of the other branches of government is supposed to be determining. This really comes up when we are talking a lot about drawing electoral districts for the House of Representatives. So if you've heard of the term gerrymandering, that is the type of issue that often comes to the Supreme Court where it says, no, this belongs to some other entity. We're not supposed to be involved in this because it's really up to the legislative branch to figure that out. We, as the court system, should not be determining whether these lines are appropriate or not. The court has actually gone back and forth on the topic of gerrymandering because there are some constitutional questions related to federal laws like the Voting Rights Act. So justiciable simply means it's something that can be decided by a court. It's not supposed to be something that the Constitution has specifically said belongs to another branch. One of the cases we'll actually cover this week, a little bit later in this podcast, has to do with whether it is justiciable and whether it belongs to another branch. But In essence, what I want you to get out of this slide is that the court does impose limits on the cases it will accept. It's got to qualify as being a case or controversy, there should be standing, it shouldn't be moot, it must be a ripe case, and the issue or the legal question must be a question that can be decided by a court that doesn't belong to the legislative or executive branch. Now, just because a case does qualify under all of those limits, let's say all of those things are active in a case, it does not mean that the Supreme Court will actually necessarily address a constitutional question in a case if there is one. Because as Justice Brandeis writes in a 1936 decision described on slide 9, the court will not pass on a constitutional question if there is also present some other ground on which the case may be disposed of. So what he's trying to say with this is that we may accept the case through those self-imposed limits, but if there's something that's a smaller question we can use to determine a case that doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional question, we'll go ahead and use that option to make the decision rather than trying to create new constitutional law through our decisions. Now, this may not make a whole lot of sense on the surface or just reading the quote, but at its core, what he's saying is, if we don't need to make it a big constitutional issue, if the case can be resolved in some other way, that's the way we're going to go about solving or addressing that case. We don't need to make it something that is this big topic or controversy if there's something lesser to the whole conversation that can actually resolve the case. So in the case of the FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, you actually see them addressing the issue of standing and not whether there is some sort of problematic process with the way the FDA looked at the medication abortion. Because they answer the question about standing first, they don't actually get to the question of whether the review of that medication was a constitutional process or followed the correct existing federal procedures. If a case can be handled with a smaller question and that will give us an outcome, the court's going to address that smaller question. Sometimes they do go a little beyond what they need to resolve a case, but for the most part, the court is going to avoid answering any constitutional questions that aren't actually required of it. One topic that becomes relevant when we're talking about the court and answering constitutional questions has to do with the distinction between what is called judicial restraint and judicial activism. Judicial restraint is largely the idea that judges will be bound by prior decisions and will stay along the same lines as those decisions when there are similar cases that come up. So if there is a case relating to manslaughter and a decision has gone one way in the past, a future case about manslaughter is going to take that same general path, or the decision will look very similar, at least as long as the case facts look pretty similar. Judicial activism, by contrast, is when we see a judge engage in a more proactive approach to decision making, which tends to set aside past decisions or maybe even existing law to rule on a case in a different way than what would be anticipated if they'd gone with what the trend had been from the past. A classic example of judicial activism is actually the Brown v. Board school desegregation case. I use it a lot as an example because it illustrates so many dynamics with the Supreme Court. But what we had seen before was that largely school segregation had been okay, as long as it followed that Plessy v. Ferguson dynamic of separate but equal. Brown v. Board throws that all into disarray because it recognizes that separate is inherently unequal. So the justices at that time are really engaging in what is called judicial activism, going away from past decisions and trends of the court and engaging in making decisions about a case that deviate from that. And when those decisions deviate, they tend to deviate in a way that perhaps aligns with that judge's maybe personal philosophy about justice. This is where judicial activism really comes into question and comes under fire. Is our judges making decisions based on the law and based on existing precedent, or are they making decisions based on their own personal viewpoint? This topic has become one that's really critical because it ties into the concept of legitimacy. When judges behave in a way that tends to align with judicial restraint for the most part, they're often recognized as engaging in legitimate decision making, and that leads to more popular acceptance of the court as an institution that can and should make those decisions. But when the court tends to engage in more judicial activism or to issue decisions that strongly move away from the things that they've determined in the past, it tends to actually threaten that legitimacy because the existing court in that judicially active decision is saying that prior courts got it wrong, right? They're actually questioning the legitimacy of the decisions of other justices, which can naturally lead others who are observing the court to think, well, who did get it right? Was it the past court? Is it the current court? Should we be accepting that the Supreme Court is the right entity to answer these questions? And is it demonstrating that it is? Slide 12 captures Justice Kagan's concerns about this, which she has spoken about before, with the quote, "All of us need to realize how precious the court's legitimacy is. It's an incredibly important thing for the court to guard this reputation of being impartial, being neutral, and not simply being an extension of a polarizing process." She's reflecting on this at a time when increasingly the court is questioned about whether it is too conservative based on the balance of six justices appointed by Republican presidents and three appointed by Democratic presidents. A lot of people have brought into question whether the court is starting to demonstrate a specifically partisan alignment with perhaps the Republican Party or at least a more conservative approach to politics than what was witnessed in the past. All right, at this point, I'm going to shift away from these larger conversations about the limits on the court or judicial review or even thinking about legitimacy, which does directly affect the court's power, to talking about the cases for this week, which outline those powers and at least address them in terms of an actual decision issued in a case. The first case we're going to talk about is Marbury versus Madison. Now, Marbury versus Madison happens in 1803, and at this point in time, what I'd like you to do is open up the case brief on this case from Canvas. If you navigate to the week 4 roadmap page for our course on Canvas and scroll all the way to the bottom of that page, you'll see a section entitled Case Briefs for this week. And underneath there are links to the Marbury versus Madison brief, the Cooper v. Aaron brief, and the Baker v. Carr brief. Go ahead and open the Marbury versus Madison brief at this point in time, and let's talk through a bit of this case and a bit of the handout. To kick off this conversation, I want to describe a little bit about what you're looking at with this handout. Now, this is the layman's terms assignment at its core. It's to develop a handout that looks somewhat like this, or maybe very much like this, depending on whether you use the template that is on Canvas and available for you or not. At the top of the page is the title of the case, which are the parties to the case, Marbury versus Madison. Marbury is the plaintiff, or the party that is bringing the complaint, and Madison is the respondent, or the party that is responding to the complaint. A quick note about the way that the parties are listed in the case. A plaintiff, or the first name listed in a Supreme Court case, is appealing the prior decision if there is one. Essentially, they want a review of the case and hopefully, in their opinion, an overturning of the prior decision because they're challenging that prior decision. The second name, the respondent, is usually the party that is okay with the prior decision and is going to appear in court if they are required, but the prior decision generally benefited them, and so they were not the one actually bringing the case to the Supreme Court and applying for it to be heard. Beneath the names of the plaintiff and the respondent is the citation information. If you had to physically look up the case, you would be looking in the documentation of Supreme Court opinions using that book and the page number. So book 5, page number 137 would bring us to Marbury versus Madison. And then, of course, the year is in the parentheses behind that. The contents of the handout begin with the details of the case. And details of the case are really the case facts. So we can see in this case that William Marbury was one of the midnight appointments. He was going to be a justice of the peace in the District of Columbia, but at the time when he was appointed, he wasn't actually delivered his commission. What's most interesting, perhaps, about the case facts here is that the person who was responsible for delivering that commission was actually the Chief Justice John Marshall himself. John Marshall had been serving as the Secretary of State, but he'd also been serving as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. There was overlap in the positions, and Marshall did not get the commission delivered before Thomas Jefferson assumed office. So this commission that's needed to validate the appointment never gets delivered to Marbury, and James Madison, who becomes the new Secretary of State, refuses to deliver it because he is pushing back against these midnight appointments. Marbury, along with four others, send a petition to the Supreme Court saying, you need to issue an order directing Madison to make him deliver this commission. And Madison challenged that. So what we end up with are three legal questions, or roughly three legal questions that the court had to answer in this case, and that's the next section of this handout. Question number one, are the individuals who were supposed to receive their commissions entitled to them? Is that a legal obligation? Number two, do those individuals have the right to a legal remedy in this situation? Meaning, do they have a remedy that the court can provide to them? And number three, does the court actually have this power? Can it issue the order to Madison as the way to resolve this problem? And the next section of the handout gives you what the decision is. Now, I've listed this as a unanimous decision, but you could just list it as decision for your heading, and you can see the vote was 4-0 in favor of Marbury on the first two questions and in favor of Madison on the third one. So this is a bit of an interesting set of responses to the legal questions. And that's actually how I want you to set up the decision section, is that for each legal question you list, there needs to be a response to that question. Or you need to note that even though those legal questions were thrown out, there was no response provided by the court. So first of all, the Supreme Court, as you can see at this time, did not have 9 justices as it does today. It was only comprised of 6 justices at the time, and 2 of those justices did not participate in the decision, which means it really came down to just 4 of the justices to decide this case. And on that first question regarding the individuals being entitled to the commissions, the answer they came to was yes. Those appointments were completed in that the president signed the commissions, so withholding them is violating the legal rights of the individuals who received the commissions. Turning to question 2, the response there is that when there is a violation of a legal right, the law indicates somebody has a right to go to court. Marbury has a right to sue. So yes, those individuals do have a legal right to a remedy in this situation. But question 3 is where this case gets really interesting. So what is being asked is, can the court issue this order, this command to Madison to be able to force him to deliver Marbury's commission? And in order to do this, what Marshall does is he basically says that this depends on if that writ and the power associated with it is something that is available to the Supreme Court. Now, the writ itself is authorized. So that power is available, but he says that's only the case if the law that it is connected to is constitutional. And this is where the judicial review comes into play. that Judiciary Act of 1789 actually goes to creating a new jurisdiction or a new form of original jurisdiction, that is, for the Supreme Court, which violates the Constitution because the framers had already outlined what the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court was. And Marshall says, if Congress remains at liberty to give this court appellate jurisdiction where the Constitution has declared their jurisdiction shall be original, and original jurisdiction where the Constitution has declared it shall be appellate, the distribution of jurisdiction made in the Constitution is form without substance. Putting this into layman's terms, what Marshall is saying is, yeah, we have the ability to issue an order like this, but the order in this case is tied to something that is unconstitutional, so we're not going to do it. So, in essence, the portion of the Judiciary Act which created this jurisdictional change is unconstitutional via judicial review, and Madison does not have to deliver it, but Marbury is entitled to it. It's the strangest result in that he actually recognizes the legal arguments of both sides without throwing himself under the bus, right? Because this is actually Marshall's fault that this commission doesn't get delivered in time. So what we're seeing is an interesting balancing act by the justices and by the Supreme Court to say, we have a right to deem this unconstitutional, but we're not going to force the executive to do something in this instance because it would be in violation of that Constitution. Truly, this is kind of a political masterpiece on the behalf of Marshall, or so I've heard it described, because he's walking a fine line between ensuring that the Supreme Court is recognized and supported by Thomas Jefferson and his cabinet, including James Madison, in the future. Because if he had forced Madison to deliver the commission, it's unlikely they would have given much credibility or legitimacy to the court. But he's also saying that Marbury has a legal right here. So he is, again, balancing between political parties and between the need for the court to be recognized as legitimate and also acknowledge the other branches without pushing them too far. When the Supreme Court is this young and this early in its development, it is reliant on other institutions to recognize and validate it, and this decision makes it possible for the executive to validate the Supreme Court and to also give the Supreme Court some of its own power in terms of that judicial review acknowledgement. One particular element of this decision that I want to highlight is a portion of the decision which is just perfectly straight legal reasoning, and we don't see it very much in court decisions, so that's why I like to highlight it in this instance. The discussion is the last bullet point on the handout, and it reads, "Between these alternatives, there is no middle ground. The Constitution is either a superior, paramount law, unchangeable by ordinary means, or it is on a level with ordinary legislative acts, and like other acts, is alterable when the legislature shall please to alter it. If the former parts of the alternative be true, then a legislative act contrary to the Constitution is not law. If the latter part be true, then written constitutions are absurd attempts on the part of the people to limit a power in its own nature illimitable." That right there is Justice Marshall laying out logical premises. Initial statements followed by secondary statements, the qualifications being true or false, and that just leads us to an absolute logical conclusion. A major premise followed by a minor premise and then a conclusion. So in this case, the major premise that Marshall is agreeing with is that the Constitution is superior paramount law, unchangeable by ordinary means. So when the legislature acts contrary to the Constitution, that is not the law. And therefore, in this case, we must find that the Judiciary Act of 1789 is not law and is unconstitutional. The remainder of the handout shows the last two sections, which are not actually involved in this case. There are potential concurring opinions or opinions that agree with the overall decision but have different reasons. And then there are dissenting opinions, opinions which disagree with the decision and provide their own different justification for their decision outcome. In future cases that we'll discuss, there will be concurring opinions and there will be dissenting opinions. But in this instance, there was just the single court's opinion that was unanimous from John Marshall. And with that, we can wrap up this handout and this case and move on to the next one, which is Cooper v. Aaron. Once you've opened the Cooper v. Aaron brief from that same section on the Week 4 roadmap page, you'll be able to see, again, a similarly structured handout with the case title, the details of the case, followed by the legal questions, the decision, and then concurring and dissenting opinion sections. Cooper v. Aaron is the actual extension case of Brown versus Board of Education. Again, I know I mention it a lot, but it is just because it is such a profoundly influential case and one that demonstrates a lot of dynamics relevant to the Supreme Court. So Cooper v. Aaron is a filing following Brown v. Board of Education. And in Brown, of course, in 1954, the Supreme Court orders the desegregation of schools. But the legislature and governor of Arkansas, whose name is Orville Faubus, it's one of the most notoriously recognized names in U.S. history, they intervene in the plan, right? The plan is to begin desegregation in the fall of 57, several years, obviously, after the Supreme Court decision, but in the between time, between 1954 and 1957, the legislature actually passes laws and a constitutional amendment that opposes the desegregation plan and calls for a pushback on the court's decision. The school board, though, goes ahead with those desegregation plans in line with the court, and they admit 9 students to Central High School. Those students are very famously known as the Little Rock 9. But in order to intervene himself, the governor orders the Arkansas National Guard to surround the school. It's made off limits to any black students, and the governor does this without contacting the school. So the National Guard is actually standing in the way of those 9 students entering the school itself. And they stayed there from September 4th until September 23rd. And at that point in time, the president of the United States at the time, Dwight Eisenhower, intervenes and he federalizes that National Guard and takes over and gives them orders to actually allow the students to be admitted. Based on all of these events, the school board pushes back on the plan for desegregation and files a suit to delay the plan by 2.5 years. And the name Cooper comes from the president of the school board for Little Rock, who was William Cooper. The name of Aaron is John Aaron, who was one of the students who had brought suit. He was initially set to enroll in one of the schools that the state forced closed. So that is where Aaron comes from in this case title. The case of Cooper v. Aaron is really a strong demonstration of the power of the judiciary because this had to be filed as a response to the failure of the state of Arkansas to desegregate the schools stemming from the original Brown v. Board decision. Now, Brown v. Board is a case that involves Kansas, but Arkansas had a back and forth between the school board and the governor and the legislature and individuals who wanted to be able to desegregate the schools. So the legal questions that came before the court in this case were, can the school board delay its plans and delay compliance with the court? And or are the state authorities, such as the governor and the legislature, restricted by the court's decision? Do they really have to follow that decision? And the case has a per curiam decision. Per curiam means that the entire court is speaking in that decision. It is by the court as it translates. So all of the justices are signing on to the decision and it's issued on behalf of the group. There's no one single author who is highlighted in these kinds of decisions. So for the first question, they say, no, you cannot delay this. The 14th Amendment says there must be equal protection of the laws. And The school board, although they may not appear to be like the government or the state, they are still part of the state, and they can't violate the 14th Amendment either. And then with the second question, this is where the real strength comes in of the judiciary by saying, nope, states must adhere to the Supreme Court's decision. The court references both Article 4 and Article 6 of the Constitution with establishing that the states are bound by the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land, and no individual state legislator, no executive, nobody can war against the Constitution without violating their oath, which they have undertaken to support that Constitution. So, in essence, the court is putting its foot down. Nope, you will not delay putting our decision into effect, and you are bound by that decision, no matter what you may think, no matter how much you may dislike it. This really is a strong assertion of the court as to its power, and really, because the Supreme Court relies on compliance by voluntary action, it's maybe one of the strongest pushes you see by the court to ensure that compliance. Of course, again, there is no authority that the court can deploy to enforce compliance. And although the president here engaged with the National Guard to enforce that desegregation, that can't be counted on because that is not a wing of the Supreme Court. That's under the executive. So that is where we wrap up the per curiam decision. And then Justice Frankfurter, actually 1 week after the decision was issued, submitted his own concurring opinion. There's not much from Frankfurter that adds to the decision, but he writes it to highlight that violent resistance to the law is not a valid reason for suspending the law. If we gave way to that, we would allow people to hijack the legal system just by virtue of engaging in violence. So, of course, this cannot be allowed to stand. You can speak against it. You cannot, quote unquote, actively get in the way of enforcing the law. We have only one concurring opinion in this case and no dissenting opinions, so that takes us through the case brief for Cooper v. Aaron. Moving on to Baker v. Carr, this case involves the issue of district lines and how do we divide districts across a state so that we can ensure proper representation of individuals in that state as far as their legislature. Now, we're dealing specifically with a state legislature here, not Congress. So what we're not talking about are the House of Representatives. We're talking about the state-level districts and the General Assembly of Tennessee. What's going on in Tennessee at the time of this case is that the original lines for the districts had been drawn in 1901, and according to the Tennessee Constitution, those lines needed to be redrawn every 10 years. And as you might imagine, the population has shifted between 1901 and 1960, as well as grown significantly. So Charles Baker, who is in a city, an urban neighborhood that has a larger population, files suit with others against the Secretary of State, Joe Carr, making the argument that they are not receiving equal protection under the 14th Amendment because their votes have less weight or power than the votes of other Tennesseans in the rural areas. And this violates the Equal Protection Clause. There's not equal protection here. The court at the district level had dismissed this because they said this was a non-justiciable case. Political apportionment or the dividing of districts, according to that court, is not a decision that's to be made by the court system. It's a decision for the legislature. It's a political question. And yet, the Supreme Court contended that that was not actually true. So the legal questions that were issued in the case were, is this issue of apportionment or dividing the districts a subject that actually can be decided by the courts and falls under their jurisdiction? That is essentially asking, you know, is this something we can decide and we can decide under our existing laws and the Constitution? The next question is, does Baker actually have an injury in this case? Does he have standing? And then the third question, is it actually a justiciable issue? Is apportionment itself as a general topic something that the court can dig into and give a remedy for? So this case brings a lot of the issues that we hear about in terms of the self-imposed limits of the court right to the Supreme Court to make a decision on. And the majority decides by a vote of 6-2 that this is something they can take, right? And it's something they can address. And yet it is something that kind of walks a fine line. Let me clarify just a little bit with that. So on question one, is apportionment a subject that falls under the jurisdiction of the courts? The answer is yes, because it's mentioned in Article 3, Subsection 2, right? Congress has given the power to the court by saying that district courts have original jurisdiction to deal with deprivations of any rights. And obviously, the right to vote is one of the rights secured by the Constitution. It's limited in listed in multiple amendments. So yes, we can in fact address this. Question number two, yes, he was actually harmed. Going back to a prior case or a precedent of Colgrove v. Green, the court had determined in that case that voters who can show there's a disadvantage, they have the right to sue. And so the court does show in that instance that voters who are deprived in some way have a harm, have an injury. And so standing is addressed in this part because we've already established beforehand that that can be a harm that the court recognizes. And the third question, is it a political question to talk about district lines? And the court says no, it's very much not. The cases which have been decided on that issue in the past, again, going back to precedent, have focused on the guarantee clause, which talks about the states needing to have a Republican form of government. This is in Article 4 of the Constitution. And so this isn't a political issue because it's discussed in the Constitution. It doesn't get allocated to one of the other branches. So the Supreme Court is an appropriate entity to step in here and issue a remedy. And one of the nice quotes that comes out of this case really helps to set up and define what a political question is. It's highlighted in bold on the case brief. A political question is one where there is a textually demonstrable constitutional commitment of the issue to a coordinate political department, or a lack of judicially discoverable and management standards for resolving it, or the impossibility of deciding without an initial policy determination of a kind clearly for non-judicial discretion, or the impossibility of a court's undertaking independent resolution without expressing lack of respect due coordinate branches of government, or an unusual need for questioning adherence to a political decision already made, or the potentiality of embarrassment from multifarious pronouncements by various departments on one question. That is a mouthful, to say the least. But they're trying to explain here what qualifies as a political question, and they're saying, nope, drawing state district lines doesn't fall under any of these. It is a question that can be decided by the courts. Now, this issue is one that continues to come before the Supreme Court, and there is a lot of contention around it. We've seen several cases come up around the process of what's called gerrymandering, or specifically drawing district lines, at least for the House of Representatives, to ensure that your candidate wins the district. And if that gerrymandering is done on a racial basis, it is consistently found to be unconstitutional. But gerrymandering on a political basis is not. We have several decisions around this topic, and we have very, very significant cases just within the last 1 to 2 years around, well, what qualifies as racial gerrymandering versus political gerrymandering? This is coming up a lot in relation to the state of Alabama at this point in time. And most recently, there was a case involving the state of South Carolina. The South Carolina case was just decided this last May. It's the decision in Alexander versus South Carolina State Conference of the NAACP. If you're interested, you can find that on oyez.org. That's oyez.org. In the search bar, go ahead and type in Alexander, Alexander, and then include V South Carolina as separate entries. If you type it in that way, it'll come up as the first case in the search results. Going back to the case brief for Baker versus Carr, we have, for the first time, several concurring opinions and several dissenting opinions. We have three concurring opinions specifically, one from Justice Douglas, one from Justice Clark, and one from Justice Stewart. And then we have two dissenting opinions, one from Justice Frankfurter, who is joined on that opinion by Justice Harlan, and one from Justice Harlan, who is joined on that opinion by Justice Frankfurter. When an opinion is listed as someone joining it, that just means that they agree with what has been written and they're adding their name to that portion of that concurring or dissenting opinion. With this case brief, because we have so many concurring and dissenting opinions, I'd like you to take the time to just read what is written there. The justices often do disagree, and those disagreements appear both in concurring and dissenting opinions. Concurring opinions are written to express someone's alternative view or alternative reasoning as to why they came to the same result as others, with dissenting obviously expressing something different. They don't support the decision and they want to explain why. After you've read through those sections, let me know if you have any questions. It's just a pretty interesting read to see how they differ and how they write about those differences. So that concludes our discussion of the case briefs that are posted, but you have two additional cases that I'd like you to spend some time looking over and trying to read through and understand a bit more as they touch on some additional points about the Supreme Court's powers, and specifically in the Nixon v. United States case, that question of justiciability. Nixon v. United States, as it's summarized on pages 100 through 105 in your textbook, also gets very heavily into demonstrating a textual approach to interpretation of the Constitution. It's so textual, in fact, it almost comes down to just one word, the word soul, S-O-L-E. Please do take a little bit of time to read through that case, try to understand more about it, and make sure you read the case facts in the italics on page 100. The case here is quite interesting and quite corrupt. Very sketchy behavior on the behalf of a judge. So take some time with that. Let me know if you have any questions, and I will be sure to get back to you on those. Last and not least, and certainly most recent, we have the case of Moore versus Harper. And if you'll go on to slide 17 for our week 4 slides, what you'll see there is the overturned congressional map that was drawn by the North Carolina legislature. So perhaps one of the more interesting arguments that's been made about the power of the courts is actually not so much about the power of the courts, but about the power of the legislative bodies that exist. And in Moore v. Harper, what was argued was that there is an independent state legislature that is empowered to make decisions without judicial review. Again, we're basically coming back to this question of justiciability. Is this a political question, or is this a question for the courts to try and decide? And what I'm asking you to do with respect to that case is to read through the syllabus. And yes, that's just like the term we use to summarize the plan for a course. But the syllabus is the introductory section for any of the Supreme Court decisions that now gets published. It's not actually written by the justices. It's written by another member of the Supreme Court's administrative team. But it's an excellent summary of the high-level things that are happening in the case. With the Moore v. Harper case, I'm asking you to read both the summary on the OIA website and those syllabus pages, which are the first 5 pages of the opinion. Now, if you click on the link for the full opinion there, what it will do is open up the full decision, which is a total of 65 pages. Remember, we're only reading the syllabus, which is listed as a header under the bold Supreme Court of the United States that appears on page 1. The syllabus is going to end almost at the very bottom of page 5. And at the bottom, it's going to list what opinions were filed in the case. So what you see there is that the Chief Justice Roberts delivered the opinion of the court. And it shows that Sotomayor, Kagan, Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Jackson joined in that majority opinion. Justice Kavanaugh filed a concurring opinion, and then we have the dissenting opinions from Justice Thomas, Justice Gorsuch, and Justice Alito. And this is a technical explanation. I want to be very clear about that. The syllabus is not intended to be easy to understand or written in layman's terms. It's meant to be a high-level summary of what was discussed in the case or what decisions were made and what questions were answered. Page one is going to lay out what was involved in the case. So they're talking about the elections clause and whether the North Carolina Supreme Court was allowed to issue a decision. And then it's going to get to on page two where there's an italicized heading called held. Where you see the held is where the syllabus is starting to explain the Supreme Court's decision and its reasoning. There are going to be numbered sections here. It's not like they're going to match up to legal questions identified in prior sections of the syllabus, but it is trying to give you a bit of a breakdown in terms of what questions were addressed. There will also be subsections under those numbers, like an A or a B, where the explanation is trying to separate the different points that are made by the court in the remaining decision. Again, this is a very technical explanation, so take your time reading it. It's a heavy 5 pages, and just do your best with it. Remember, we're trying to just get some experience with this, so we're going to practice and keep practicing and do our best to understand the complexities that appear in Supreme Court decisions. On that note, I'm going to wrap up this podcast episode. We have covered a lot this week. We've done quite a few cases, and that is probably going to be what you should expect going forward. We're going to have the material from the textbook, but I'm going to supplement it with cases and case materials. I'm going to limit that discussion more and more as we get further along into doing the layman's terms handouts and those assignments, because I would like you to use the materials that others in your class are creating to help understand those cases. When I receive those briefs from you for the layman's terms assignments, I will post them on Canvas so that you can find them at the bottom of the roadmap page for the week in which that case was reviewed. And another note quickly on those layman's terms, I have received the surveys and will be sending out your layman's terms assignments this week. So if you haven't seen it yet, just know it is still forthcoming. Thank you all for joining me again for these podcasts. I do hope they're helping. Please contact me if you have any questions or concerns. I'm at jemille1@wsc.edu. Talk to you again soon.